Counsel, are you all ready? All right, if you would call the next case, please.
We now call for a Texas Voices for Reason and Justice Incorporated. May I please report, this is Rachel Briggs Clark, who will argue for the appellant. This is Rachel Blackie, who will argue for the appellate.
May it please the court, Fritz Quast on behalf of the city of Westworth Village. First of all, I'd like to apologize to the court. I thought that I was going to be able to get into bed by about 8 p.m. or 9 p.m. last night, but there's some things on TV happening, so I stayed up past midnight to see what was going to happen. So if I have a lapse or forget where I am, that is why. This is, of course, an appeal from a denial of the city's plea to the jurisdiction. Very similar to the previous lawsuit. Actually, the allegations are absolutely the same. The city asserted that Texas Voices for Reason and Justice Incorporated does not have associational standing to bring any claims challenging the city's sex offender residency ordinance under the Hunt standard, and they cannot allege any injury in fact. Of course, this case, like the prior case, concerns a challenge to all general law cities' statutory authority to enact sex offender residency restrictions. Westworth Village passed a sex offender residency ordinance in 2007. It requires everyone that's required to register under Chapter 62, this Code of Criminal Procedure, where the victim was under 17. They can't establish a temporary or permanent residence within 1,000 feet of places where children commonly gather. That's specifically defined under the ordinance: playground, school, public or private youth center, daycare facility, video arcade facility, and a public swimming pool. Those terms are all defined under state law and the Texas Controlled Substances Act, that those definitions are incorporated into the ordinance. So each of these categories is pretty specifically and well defined. That's in section 148-143 of the Texas Health and Safety Code. Texas Voices for Reason and Justice, the appellee, was incorporated as a nonprofit corporation on February the 2nd of 2011. The certificate of formation specifically says, and the box was checked, this is a form, the nonprofit corporation, quote, has no members. Of course, that's in the clerk's record. On the eve of this lawsuit, about 20 days or 28 days beforehand, the board of Texas Voices for Reason and Justice amended its bylaws, not the certificate, but the bylaws, to have a general membership. And essentially, it defines members as anybody that, well, you express a desire to join, you just got to share your views with us, and, you know, you can give us money if you want. This suit was filed, one of many that were filed about the same time across the state, on December the 28th of last year, alleging that some of the members of Texas Voices for Reason and Justice want to live in the city of Westworth Village. Just a bare desire, that's it. But the sex offender residency restriction ordinance prohibits them from doing so in a, quote, this is from their pleading, a geographically significant or substantial area of the city of Westworth Village. So essentially, they're saying, we've got some members, they want to live in the city of Westworth Village, but they can't live everywhere in the city of Westworth Village. The law, very briefly, is, of course, for an organization to have standing to assert a claim on behalf of a member, it has to have members, it has to be an organization, and at least one of those members has to have an individual standing. The interest that the organization is asserting are germane to the purpose of the organization. The claim of relief does not require the individual members to be parties. Of course, I'm going to focus on the first prong of that test. Incorporating the first prong is the member or a member has to have individual standing. The first element of individual standing is, of course, injury in fact. So I'm asserting two issues. They don't really have any members. They don't have any members officially under state law. They don't have any members under the more lax indicia of membership test under the Hunt case. And we believe that the evidence in the record is pretty conclusive. You can decide it as a matter of law. And if you agree with the city of Westwood Village, you should dismiss it. Reverse and render dismissal for lack of standing. If they do have members, there's not a sufficient allegation in the pleadings of an injury in fact. And, of course, I don't think that the allegations are necessarily conclusive of that issue. It's just they're not sufficient. Therefore, if you only sustain issue two, I'm asking that the court give the trial court some instructions, reverse and remand for further proceedings, asking that the plaintiff, or excuse me, the appellee, more specifically allege an injury in fact. Issue one, does Texas Voices for Reason and Justice have members or at least somebody with a sufficient indicia of membership under the Hunt case? That's the Washington State Apple Advertising Commission versus Hunt, a U.S. Supreme Court case from 1977. First things first, the Texas Voices for Reason and Justice does not have any members under state law. Their certificate of formation says they don't have any members. They tried to amend their certificate of formation by amending their bylaws. That is, under statutory law, under Texas law, it's a nullity. The bylaws conflict with the certificate, and therefore, it doesn't matter. It's like it didn't happen. So their certificate of formation still, or at least at the time this lawsuit is filed, which is the only time it matters, they don't have any members. Now, is that dispositive of issue one? I wish it were. But I think the whole purpose of the Hunt case and its progeny was to say that there might be situations where there aren't traditional members, and therefore we need to look at the facts underlying to decide whether there's at least somebody out there with some control over the governing body of the organization, such that there are members at least for the purposes of standing. So if we look at the Hunt versus Washington State Apple Advertising Commission, that was a case where a state agency in Washington sued an official in North Carolina over some apple advertising. Apparently the people in Washington want their apples to be advertised in a certain way. North Carolina had a rule that said you couldn't advertise in that way. So the state agency asserted claims on behalf of the growers and distributors of apples in Washington. Essentially, it's a state agency, doesn't really have members, but under the state statute, govern that agency. Essentially, the growers and distributors of apples, the dealers of apples, had every right to elect the members of the commission and to fund the commission with mandatory assessments set by state law. So, court said it's not a traditional voluntary membership association, but the growers and dealers of apples in Washington possess all the indicia of membership in an organization. They alone elect the members of the commission. They alone serve on the commission, and they alone finance its activities. Those are the three facts that the court highlighted in Hunt to say, hey, these people aren't really members, but they have what usually we think of as a membership in an organization. So, again, the members in Texas Voice for Reason and Justice, they can at most contribute financially, and that's essentially it. And it's our position that none of the facts of the Hunt test are satisfied. The members of the board, although they can give money and they can express their views to the board, they can't elect the board. And there's no requirement that they serve on the board or only members serve on the board. And there is no requirement that they submit dues or any other financial support. So none of the elements in Hunt are satisfied. So the next question becomes, do we have to satisfy all the elements of Hunt? There are no specific cases. Of course, I think there's some Fifth Circuit cases I said in the brief You've got to check all three boxes, but the cases are all over the place. So at the very least, even the case that they cite, you have to have some sort of voting control over the governing body of the organization. And here, we don't have that. It's just a self-appointing, self-perpetuating board. The board just can get somebody off the street when somebody resigns from the board. No one elects the board. So we think that that makes it very clear that the Hunt test, as a matter of law, can't be satisfied. With respect to issue two, again, the allegations are, we want to live in Westwood Village, but we can't live everywhere. Well, our position, of course, is just looking at the allegations. Those are insufficient. It admits that there are potentially places in Westwood Village that might be suitable for those members to live. So they need to be able to show us why, or allege specifically why they want to live in protected areas. Now I'm going to show you a copy of a map. And if the court cannot see that far, may I approach?
Yes.
Thank you.
This map is not in the record, but I'm going to ask the court to take judicial notice of it under 201 and 204 of the Rules of Evidence. It's part of the ordinance. There's a provision in the ordinance that says the city has to maintain this map. We have to make it available to the public. It's published on the police department website. And essentially, the ordinance, the only protected area in the city of Westworth Village, or protected property under the ordinance, is Burton Hill Elementary School. And even though that area looks really small on the map, it's even smaller because, if you'll notice, this area to the south, it's in the city of Fort Worth, municipal law 101. Westwood Village can enforce its residency restrictions in the city of Fort Worth. If you look to the east, that's mostly levees and river, the west fork of the Trinity River. If you look to the north, this is going to be the Westwood Village Municipal Complex. There's even a church right here. So if you... And I did this when I was very tired, but looking on Google Earth, there's probably only about 120 to 130 residences in the city of Westwood Village where that are in the protected zone. So essentially, I think this shows that their pleading standard is even heightened. They have to explain, to show an injury in fact, why they're so jazzed and why they have a member or two, possibly, that wants to live in this little corner of Westworth Village. So they have not done that. The pleadings are insufficient. And we can contrast. I mean, what do they need to allege, I guess, is what your next question would be. Well, let me just contrast this case with the Rice case. It's before this court, submitted on March 1st, 2016. The allegations in that case, City of Crum, a guy was living in a house, at least these are the allegations, I don't know if they're true, living in a house, and he'd lived there with his parents since birth. He was 22 years old, and he was told to get. That might be something that would tie you to a specific area. There are other residency restriction standing cases that talk about, well, it's close to your work, or it... you have a relative across the street, or I grew up in this house, or, I have a particular affinity for this neighborhood because of X, Y, and Z. Just saying that we want to live in Westworth Village without tying it to the specific area where the ordinance applies or in the protected area is not a sufficient allegation of an injury in fact. Unless the court has any other questions, I see I'm about to run out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. The issues on this appeal, I think, are basically broken down into two parts. The first one is whether Texas Voices for Reason and Justice have, as a factual matter, any members. The second question is, if they do have members, whether the allegations in our original petition adequately allege facts which would give them standing. As I say on page 25 of my brief, and it's actually a quote from a case that I've been involved in, Duarte versus the City of Louisville, and again, that's on page 25 of my brief. What the Fifth Circuit said in its first decision in that case concerning standing was the question is whether the plaintiff is himself an object of the government action or foregone action at issue. If he is, there is ordinarily little question that the action or inaction has caused him injury, and that a judgment preventing or requiring the action by the government will redress it. There is no dispute in this case that their ordinance applies to people who are required to register under Chapter 62 of the Code of Criminal Procedure. Before getting into that, I'm going to get briefly at least on the first issue. What arose in this case was is that, as explained in the affidavit that I attached to my response to the plea of jurisdiction in the trial court, this organization started building up in about 2008 and now has several thousand members actually statewide as well as chapters. When they did their original incorporation documents, they chose not to have any voting members, but and so they checked that box on the page when they incorporated. Before the suit was filed, they amended their bylaws to recognize that the board members or the organizing officials or managing officials were required to be responsive to the membership, even though they would still not have any voting rights, and that they would be responsive primarily as a result of either the comments at meetings or withholding of financial resources or giving of financial resources and those sorts of things would result in some control over the direction the organization was heading, including, in fact, the filing of this lawsuit and others. They did not amend their certificate of incorporation when they did that. So the question is whether Texas law, first of all, whether this organization is incorporated with members, and if it's not, whether or not as an organization it would have the ability to sue under associational standing doctrines. That is the one adopted by the Supreme Court in Texas Business Associations versus Texas Air Control Board. As the court may be aware, in that Texas Supreme Court case, they adopted the Supreme Court's three-prong test. In this case, we're only dealing with the first factor or prong of that test, and that is whether the individual members of the organization or group would themselves have standing if they had chosen to bring the lawsuit themselves. And so the defendants broke this into two parts. Number one, we don't have members since there's a technical defect in the incorporating documents. And then number two, if we do have members, we have not alleged adequately that we have members who are registrants, since there is no dispute about whether this ordinance applies to registrants. With regard to the areas that the registrants are prohibited from living in, this is an issue that actually came up. The Fifth Circuit case, Duarte versus Louisville, is actually based upon a procedural due process under federal constitutional law. And when we had oral argument last summer in the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans, the question came up is, does it make a difference whether there's only 0.02% housing within the city limits, or whether it's 50-50, or whether it's some other percentage, in determining whether those registrants have a liberty interest or not. Our position was then is that because the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized a fundamental right to establish a home, if you show there's some regulation or interference with the exercise of that in a way that's different than it would be for someone who's not in another class, perhaps a non-registrant in this case, then the ordinance does apply to you, and you do have standing. Now,
One house, Mr. Glidden, if you had just one house, one person, one house.
If, okay. If a city ordinance said you can't live in this house, the question in this case is that we don't have a federal liberty interest claim. What we have in this case is an Ultra-Virus Act claim, is that it's been established for at least since 1875 that general law cities don't have any authority to enact a ordinance such as this. The Attorney General of Texas, then now Governor Abbott, wrote in a legal opinion telling these cities in 2007 it was an Ultra-Virus Act and they couldn't do it, and they decided to do it anyway. And so we're not really dealing with a question of to what extent it interfered with the liberty interest, whether it's one house or 100. It's a question of whether from the get-go, ab initio, it was or was not an Ultra-Virus Act. And under the, and I forget the name of it because it's been a while since I looked at it, but if you look at the petition, I spell out at length and actually cite to a legal treatise that was relied upon by the Texas Constitutional Convention in 1875 in coming up with this distinction between general law cities and home rule cities. And so that's what distinguishes this case from the Duarte case. Now, the extent to which they are claiming that we should have more specific or detailed allegations factually in our petition, they rely on a detailed discussion of the facts in the Duarte case in the first Fifth Circuit decision before it was remanded back to the trial court. That case was on review after the U.S. District Court granted summary judgment to the defendants. For that reason, there is volumes and volumes of evidence and deposition excerpts and things of that nature. And when they reversed the U.S. District Court and the District Court's order granting summary judgment, it therefore went through the summary judgment evidence upon which the District Court had in front of it when it erroneously ruled that my clients in that case did not have standing. And they did find that my clients in that case had standing, but it had nothing to do with a limited analysis of whether the allegations were sufficient or not. In this case, it's our contention that the District Court, State District Court, was correct in finding that our allegations on the standing were adequate. We spent, in the record, you'll see that we spent a lot more time talking about whether an organization can have standing to sue on behalf of individual members, and whether the U.S. Supreme Court meant that definition to be limited by a Texas statute, or whether it's more of a doctrinal rule, judicially created, which it was, and that's how it should be applied. And we even cite a case that before there ever was a business and commerce code or corporations code, it was not uncommon at all for organizations that weren't incorporated and did not have filings establishing themselves as even business associations, that under the common law in Texas, groups could sue on behalf of their members, provided there was, as now is the doctrine, indicia of control. The law review articles that I cite in my brief discuss the fact that voting authority is not a criteria and not determinative at all. And that fact, the interaction between a governing official or governing officials over a group can often provide standing if the membership can express their opinions about the direction the organization should go, including but not limited to not volunteering with the group, not paying money or donating money to the group to function. And under their definition of standing, associational standing, Alcoholics Anonymous, or groups of Alcoholics Anonymous, would not have any members because it was not, the individual group wasn't incorporated, and all they had was people that showed up, participated, expressed their opinions, and showed an interest in the direction the organization could go, or the group. And that's just too narrow a definition of whether someone does or doesn't have standing under the Supreme Court's decision in Texas Business Association. In this case, the only evidence submitted in the pleaded jurisdiction related to their discovery with the Texas Secretary of State that a box had been checked saying no members when the organization originally was incorporated. You have the minutes in the record of when the bylaws were changed to recognize membership for non-voting purposes. So, number one, we don't think that, and a lot of our responsive affidavits, there's very least a fact question as to whether or not our affidavit's true or not, and the 8-year or more history of meetings and chapters statewide. And for that reason, the trial court acted properly by denying the plea of jurisdiction on that issue. With regard to the standing, we submit to you that the district court correctly ruled that we had adequately alleged facts alleging standing. Again, we allege that that our members are registrants, that the ordinance applies. And going to the quoted passage on page 25, it's really a question of whether the government action at issue does or does not apply to my clients in a way that's different to people generally, and whether it's, and if it does, and then as the court said, ordinarily there's little question that they're standing. As far as this injury, they're not talking about people having to wait till they've been injured. It's a question of whether they are being affected in a unique way, and we certainly have alleged that, and I think that's pretty much all I've got, unless the court has anything else it needs to ask me.
Thank you, Mr. Gladden.
Oh, wait, if I can make one more point, I'm sorry. Both this group of defendants, or this defendant and the prior group of defendants, seem to think that this court, or in this case at least, that the Court of Appeals could reverse the trial court's judgment and grant the plea to jurisdiction without remanding it to the trial court first. The standard rule under Texas Wildlife versus Miranda is that if a plaintiff could plausibly amend their petition, that it's just basically a defect in pleading, that plaintiffs are entitled to that opportunity. There are other cases applying that rule that say the same rule would apply in the Court of Appeals, and that even if this court were to reverse the trial court and find there's an inadequacy in the factual allegations for standing purposes, it even more so would it be necessary for the court to remand the case so that the trial court could then give a plaintiff the opportunity to amend. We don't think that's necessary in this case, but it kind of bothers me that at least my opposing counsel in this case is saying you can reverse the trial court, take up the plea to jurisdiction yourself, and dismiss it without affording a plaintiff the opportunity to amend. So for all these reasons, we think the trial court should be affirmed, and that's the relief we request. Thank you.
Biden, is it your position that if this case were sent back to the trial court, then pleadings could be filed that would meet the requirements of standing as advanced by the appellants in this case?
Well, I assume that they probably would. It would be possible, but that should be taken up by a special exception. It wouldn't be necessarily a jurisdictional matter. What we're talking about is jurisdictional allegations, factual allegations relating to jurisdiction. Again, the defendant in this case seems to think that I should have to plead such detail, as much detail as the Fifth Circuit did in its several-page opinion that was dealing with summary judgment and excerpts from depositions and those sorts of things. I don't think our pleading process in Texas requires someone to meet some heightened level of pleading that would basically be numerous additional pages and facts that do far more than just provide notice to the defendant.
So if I hear you say, yeah, we can do it, but we don't want to.
Well, I suspect I will be amending this as time goes along. In fact, I'll be doing a motion for summary judgment on it, which will obviously have attachments to it and additional facts and detail. But as a matter of pleading, if you're talking about jurisdiction, the question is whether or not the pleadings themselves adequately allege a cause of action under which the court would have jurisdiction. And it doesn't really need to allege things that would entitle it to a judgment if they are all presumed true. It just needs to have a plausible basis upon which relief could be granted. Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments. Your case is submitted.
You got a rebuttal?
Oh, I'm sorry. Forgive me, Mr. Quatz.
I think that's a sign I should be quick. All right. Well, I'll try to do that.
Judge Walker was probably in bed earlier than I was.
Very quickly, I just want to make a clarification here. All right. The burden shifting we're talking about, pleas to the jurisdiction and allegations and when you submit evidence is this. Look, plaintiff has the initial burden to allege facts that demonstrate jurisdiction, one. If those facts are sufficient, the burden shifts to the defendant. The defendant can support the plea with evidence to negate those factual allegations. And then the burden shifts back to the plaintiff to raise a fact issue. That's the three-step burden shifting process. And what I'm saying is, for the first issue, they have alleged that they have members. And everyone, we submitted evidence, they submitted evidence, and now all you have to do, there's evidence in the record that shows the relationship between the members and the organization. There's nothing left to question. You can decide it as a matter of law. And if you do, that's a reversal and a rendition of dismissal for want of jurisdiction. With respect to the second issue, I recognize that they could amend their pleadings to fix the deficiencies. That's why I have asked, if you only sustain issue two, to remand to the trial court so that they can have a chance to amend. Hopefully, if you issue an opinion on issue two, it will give him instructions on what might be sufficient to allege injury in fact in these circumstances. So, with respect to the Duarte opinion, here's the opinion. And again, I know this is after evidence is submitted and this is in a summary judgment proceeding. Duarte is the target of the Louisville ordinance restricting where registered child sex offenders like him can live. Duarte submitted evidence that, taken in the light most favorable to him, establishes that he had concrete plans to reside in areas impacted by the Louisville ordinance. Again, he needs to show why these members of these have a desire to live in that specific particular area. And of course, before we get to the evidence stage, we need to have some allegations to back those up before we can prove them. Lastly, I don't want to get into what will eventually be the merits in one of these cases, one of these 40 or so cases that's been filed across the state, but the AG making a offhand statement and opinion is not binding on this court or any court in the state for that matter. Issue one, with respect to what do you need to have an indicia of membership? They're saying that all you have to do is, you can support the organization and go to meetings and, we want members or people that say they're members to support us legislatively. And you can, give us financial contributions if you wish.
Well, isn't the whole purpose of the membership requirement to prevent fictitious suits or basically advisory opinions?
That is absolutely correct.
So it doesn't seem like the membership burden is very high.
It is not, but it has to be something. And essentially, what the purpose of that is to make sure that the organization that's asserting is beholden in some respect to the interests, to the people whose interests they purport to represent. In this case, it's just, you just say you agree with us and that's it. There's no voting requirement. The board of directors of the organization, they're beholden only to themselves officially. There's no requirement. There's no dues. It's just, I say that I support you, and that is insufficient. There are no cases. There's a law review article, but there are no actual cases that I've been able to locate, or Ms. Durker, who's also helped me look, that support that notion that all you need is bare support. You need some sort of actual institutional control over the head of the organization. Any other questions, I will give my time back to the court.
Thank you, Mr. Quast.
Thank you.
All right, now your case is submitted.